What I'm getting at here is that man has an innate linguistic ability. Earlier in tonight's lecture, didn't I tell you that man is the image of God, and God is what? A linguistic being. God is a speaking being, communicating being. And I think that's part of the mystery of man that sets him apart from other sentient beings in the universe, is that man has a linguistic ability. And it's not just like you can teach an ape to have the right stimulus and response, and even to make choices and so forth. It's that man has a kind of creativity and what is called a depth grammar. Somebody who's not a Christian at all has done great work in this, Noam Chomsky, where there is an underlying grammar, if you will, in all linguistic communities. There has to be something that makes it possible for man to begin learning a language. And we as Christians have an answer to that, and everybody else just stands back and says, boy, isn't evolution mysterious? Okay.
I'm gonna think about it before I ask.
Noam Chomsky was a Christian?
No, was not a Christian. No, what I was getting at is that somebody who's not even a Christian has done marvelous work in showing how utterly incredible it is to believe a behavioristic or evolutionary view of man. Yet how do you account for the depth grammar that makes the learning of language possible? All right, as I told you at the beginning of my lecture, I'm concerned with language and meaning in particular, and I'm now going to start a series of considerations that will narrow what we said about language and symbols and so forth now to the meaning of language. And my first observation, what point am I at in my outline? Five now or
six?
Five. Meaning is not some impersonal feature unconnected to intentionality. That's my thesis. Meaning is not some impersonal feature unconnected to intentionality. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, if I'm correct, I think I am, for that reason you will never, ever have a computer that can translate properly. Keep it close, but because computers can't deal with intentionality, computers can't translate. They can't finally get to the meaning of things. Meaning is not some impersonal feature unconnected to intentionality. It's people, not things, that mean something by what they do or say. People, not things, mean something by what they do or say. Or people who find and invest meaning in other things or events, whether they're in part or in whole, those things and events. We can talk about the meaning of this movie, or the meaning of life, or the meaning of the projector. I mean, that it's people who talk about the meaning of things and invest things with meaning. A comedian once said, it's not really all that funny, but I remember him saying he finally figured out what the meaning of life was. He said it's golf. Well, if that were to be taken seriously, that is to say he has invested the meaning of life in golf, right? But the point is, a person has to do that. Rocks don't invest meaning in other things. So it's people who mean things or find and invest meaning. People find meaning, they invest things with meaning, and they mean things. I can't stress this too much. Meaning is a function of personality or intentionality then. And thus, when two linguistic expressions have the same meaning, they do so because the speakers do the same thing with them. Two linguistic expressions have the same meaning when speakers do the same thing with them. The meaning of an expression is always related to the way in which it is used by the speaker or the writer. The way in which it is used. That is to say, the way in which it does things for him. But I mean does things by intention, not by accidental result. two linguistic if the meaning of an expression is the way it's used to do something, then two linguistic expressions have the same meaning when the speakers do the same thing with them. So if Jesus preaches, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." The expression, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand," has the same meaning, just to give you an illustration, as the preacher in 20th century America who says, "Confess your sins because God's saving dominion has come." Now maybe I'm not right, you might be able to fault my illustration, but I'm trying to show you how I'm using the concept of meaning. I'm saying those two expressions have the same meaning because the two speakers, Jesus many years ago and the 20th century preacher, are doing the same thing with the two expressions. Now that's very rough and ready. There's a whole lot more that needs to be said. But I'm just getting at now that meaning is a function of intentionality. Doing something with an intention. Doing something with an intention. Okay. Number six. I'm going to start chipping away now at meaning and various views of meaning until I finally get to my final climax, which is to lay out the different senses in which we speak of the meaning of a sentence. Number six. We use language to quote-unquote communicate our thoughts. We use language to communicate our thoughts. I want to stress the commune part there. Language is used, this is one insight that's valuable, is used to bring a community of thought, or as we say, to share ideas. To share ideas. That's a valuable insight, but it shouldn't lead us to think that the meaning of an expression is identical with the idea with which it is associated. So I'm affirming that language is used to commune in thought or to share ideas, to communicate. However, I do not believe that meaning, the meaning of an expression, is identical with the idea with which it is associated. I'm referring here to the famous thesis of the philosopher John Locke that words are external signs of invisible ideas by means of a voluntary imposition. Locke said words are external signs, okay? I can write chair on a board externally, but it's an external sign of an invisible idea in my head, and the connection is made by voluntary imposition. I've invested this on the board here, you know, with the meaning or the significance of the idea in my head. However, this, what's sometimes called the ideational theory of meaning, that meaning has to do with ideas in our heads, the sharing of ideas. This ideational idea is mistaken for a number of reasons, I think. First of all, we do not conjure up distinguishable ideas corresponding to each of the words in a sentence we use. I think the only reason people ever thought that we do is because we teach children sentences that way. Now you can build up your reading ability by first understanding Dick, understanding Jane, understanding run, understanding spot, understanding ball. Say Dick and Jane ran up the hill, hit the, you know, whatever. And you can, little by little, you can learn a sentence that way. But that's not what's going on when we use a sentence. You may learn to read that way, but when I use the sentence, the Dodgers will not be in first place this year. I did not, when I used that sentence, which I just made up, I'm not reading out of my notes, when I did that, I did not stop to have an idea, Dodgers, first place, not, and so forth, in my head. You may think, well, but you must have, because how could you put the sentence together? Well, we're not going to get into all this, some very interesting things about psychology and linguistic use,
where we have things that really flow together and we're used to putting them together without stopping to chunk by chunk by chunk have idea, 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 idea. And then I finally, you know, spit it out. It's kind of like I'm typing it in my head. If I could use a crude analogy. Type this word, type this word, type this word, type. And finally when the sentence is done, then finally out of the mouth comes, the Dodgers won't ever be in first place this year. That's just not true. We do not conjure up distinguishable ideas corresponding to each of the words in the sentences we use. Another problem with the ideational theory is that sentences can be used meaningfully even when corresponding ideas are not presently in the mind of the speaker. We can sometimes, as we say, thoughtlessly utter sentences. I am sure that when I call certain bureaucrats who work for, say, the gas company or the phone company, that I get answers back from them, and there is nothing in their head when they are talking, much less the ideas that are coming out of their mouths, because it's become just something that they say, you know? Now, but what they're saying has enough meaning that it can irritate me, or that I can disagree with it, or maybe even I can get the instructions I need to find them. You know, I think there are receptionists who can give directions to their store without thinking about who they're going to go out with that night. That's what's in their head, and yet their mouths are saying things which, in fact, are very meaningful and true. You can find the store following them. But the ideational theory doesn't seem to correspond very well to that experience. Moreover, some words do not associate with any definite idea at all. What is the idea you have when I use the word not?
Negation.
You don't have an idea of negation. You have a function. There is a function called negation, but no one has an idea of negation.
What's your Heidegger?
You know how to play this game, though. How about the word when? What idea comes to mind when I use the word when? Well, the interesting thing is you know how to use the word when. You know how that functions in our language, but it's not because of an idea that is separate for when. Moreover, even in the case of mental images that are associated with words, these are supposed to be the easy cases. Even in the case of mental images associated with words, the image is not the same every time we use the corresponding word, is it? Ever thought about that? When you use the word dog, even if you have a mental image of a dog, you don't have the same mental image every time, unless you're a very boring person. I don't think it's true of hardly anybody that thinks of the same dog every time you use the word dog, or the same chair, or the same nose, you know? We all know how to use the word nose, but I don't think the mental image of the nose is the same every time we use it. Moreover, the mental image of a running football player, for instance, could accompany quite different words. Words that have different meanings, and yet that might be the mental image I have. What words might fit where the mental image corresponding to them is a running football player? Well, running. If I use the word running, I might think of a running football player. When I use the word football player, I might use the same mental image, right? Does that mean running and football player mean the same thing? Of course not. How about if someone says, think of an athlete. I think running football player. Well, now, is that running or is that athlete or is that football player? Or sports event. Maybe the linguistic expression sports event conjures up in my mind a running football player. You begin to see the difficulty. The ideational theory just doesn't seem to work. Not that I want to deny that we communicate, we share ideas, but it doesn't seem to be the essence of meaning that I'm trying to get an idea that's invisible, externalized by a voluntary imposition, as Locke said. And this is just for the advanced students who are here or listening by tape. One last criticism. Successful communication on the ideational theory would entail the hearer having the same idea as that expressed by the speaker. That is, if meaning has to do with sharing ideas, then successful communication, successful sharing of ideas, would call for what? Introspection, the discrimination of items of consciousness, and a comparison the introspected items of consciousness in two different minds. It doesn't seem likely that that's really what we're getting at when we talk about the meaning of expressions, therefore communicating them. I'm going to carry this a bit further. Although I've just said that the theory of meaning that says meaning is an expression with expression of an idea associated with it, even though that theory founders, you could nevertheless say that meaning is found in the speaker's head. Now, there's a way in which you could say that. It's not ideational. It's not because there's this idea sort of idea. But we have, if we're going to make this work at all, here's the interesting thing. Meaning can be said to be in a speaker's head, but not ever simply in his head or in his mind privately. For those of you who've done other work, what I'm referring to here is Wittgenstein's famous diatribe against private language. Meaning may be in a person's mind, but it can't ever simply be in a person's mind or a private matter. Because even for the speaker, the meaning that is quote-unquote in his mind, to speak metaphorically, even for the speaker, it is a reflection and a function of his linguistic community. Earlier we had said language is deeper than speech. That is, the rules and conventions for symbolizing and communicating have to be present, even if a man's talking to himself privately. I mean, we may not ever share our thoughts, but our thoughts, to the extent that they have linguistic meaning, are built against a social convention for the use of language. Now, these rules for the use of terms, mind you, these conventions, are not an unavoidable ideological straitjacket, as though a person's linguistic community constrains what meanings are permitted within that community. I mean, you're not hearing this lecture properly if you're led to that kind of conclusion. No one is saying that the conventions keep you from being able to think of God as a triune being. You have people who will say that. Say, well, you come to some cultures and you just can't think that way in these cultures. No. We're talking about something, a deft grammar, a convention in the use of language that doesn't tell you what ideas you can finally have, but it does tell you how you're going to combine them and communicate them, even to yourself. The fact is, we can examine other cultures and other linguistic communities for comparison. And so even though I learned language first through English, I nevertheless am able to compare Greek-speaking cultures and to learn something about them and their conventions for usage and so forth. So I'm not trying to so emphasize convention that I've made it a straitjacket from what you're allowed to think or able to think. But I want to make the point that linguistic meaning is tied to psychology. We started there. It's tied to intending, wanting, desiring. Linguistic meaning is an aspect of psychology, but it's also tied to social conventions and structure, be they behavioral conventions or verbal conventions. As Wittgenstein taught us, the range of uses for linguistic tools is determined by the behavior patterns and public traditions shared in a society. Let me say that again. The range of uses for linguistic tools is determined by the behavior patterns and public traditions shared in a society. I'm not going to use a linguistic illustration here, but I think you can get the point very easily. If I were to draw an arrow on the board, okay, so I draw this line here, and then I put the head of the arrow on it. I draw this arrow, and then I ask you, which way is the arrow pointing? And I'm just going to say, well, what a elementary school question, Dr. Watson, and that's easy. We all know the arrow's pointing this way. But now I want you to go back and stop and examine that. How did you know the arrow was pointing that way? It's certainly not because of anything in the arrow, though you think it is. We tend to, for economy, we say, well, of course, that's why it's designed that way. But if you stop and think about it, there could be a culture where its traditions, its behavior patterns are such that when you want to point at something, you give a base to it, and then the long line coming out of the base shows you where you're supposed to go. So it's like within this range, go that way. Which would completely reverse the meaning of arrow, you know. And that's a cultural matter. I don't know if there are any cultures like that. I'm making that up. But that's just to show you, in a crude way, what Wittgenstein is getting at. The range of uses for our linguistic behavior is going to, in some way, be defined by the conventions of the society in which we use the language. And so for a sentence to mean something is identical with it being used with the intention of bringing about a certain expected result in an audience. For a sentence to mean something is to say that it is used with the intention of bringing about a certain expected result in the audience. But let's jump on this quick. Does this mean that you always bring about the expected result? Is that the meaning of the sentence? Of course not. We sometimes misfire in our use of language, don't we? Have you ever tried to compliment somebody and through your clumsy use of language insult them? It happens.
Repeat your definition of...
For a sentence to mean something, it's not so much a definition, I'm giving a mark of it, I think. Anyway, for a sentence to mean something is for it to be used with the intention of bringing about a certain expected result in an audience. Sometimes we try to tell a joke, right? We intend to bring about the effect of laughter. The result? Boredom. We bomb, right? So I'm not saying that the meaning of the sentence is found in the response of the audience. But the meaning of a sentence is its intention to bring about a certain expected result in an audience. And we must recognize that language acquires its meaning, therefore, through being used by people as they are involved in various kinds of social behavior. Language acquires its meaning through being used, underline the word used by people, as they are involved in various kinds of social behavior. To put it briefly, speech is a kind of action looking for a response according to convention. That's a nifty way to summarize where we've gone so far. We have a lot further to go. Speech is a kind of action looking for a response according to convention. Okay, let me just rehearse where we've come to and then I'll proceed. Six, I think, was my observation that meaning is a personal feature tied to intentionality. Seven was a discussion of the fact that language communicates, shares ideas, and yet that doesn't tie us to the ideational theory of language. Eight, meaning is in the speaker's mind, but not simply in the speaker's mind, and that's because it's tied to social convention and structure. And that has led me to my observation that speech is a kind of action and intention looking for a response, but according to a convention. Before I go on to nine, this is not to claim, I'm not claiming in this, that language has meaning in virtue of stimulus-response connections. I want you to notice what I'm doing in my lecture. I first observed that language communicates. It's an attempt to share ideas, but then I didn't want to buy into the ideational theory of meaning. I'm now admitting that language is a matter of behavior and social behavior, but I'm not buying into the behaviorist or stimulus-response theory of language. And I'd like to explain to you why. The behavioral view sees the meaning of a verbal token as it's regularly evoking certain responses. Or if you get more sophisticated, the meaning of a verbal token is its evoking of a disposition to respond under appropriate conditions. Okay, so what's the meaning of the expression, pass me the salt? The meaning of the expression would be, it's evoking the response of you reaching over, getting the salt shaker and handing it to me. Or, since that has some real problems with it, a more sophisticated way is to say that the meaning is that it evokes in you a disposition under the proper circumstances. Namely, you want to be kind to me. Namely, you don't think I'm telling a joke. You don't think the salt's going to kill me, and on and on and on. Okay, so it's a disposition under appropriate conditions. But the behavioral theory of language, that the meaning is tied to stimulus response, is really unworkable. First of all, how is it decided which responses are relevant to the meaning of the sentence in question? What if I say, pass me the salt, please, and you belch? Now I'm using, you know, a way out example. Now, we would say, well, that's not relevant to the meaning of pass me the salt. Well, but how did we know that? Certainly not on the basis of stimulus response. What if it so happened that on a number of significant occasions when I ask for the salt to be passed, people belch? Would I then say, oh, well, I guess since that response is there in a high number of cases, that's part of the meaning of pass me the salt. Now, we know that that one is not, I mean, I'm using one that it's obvious that it's not true to the meaning of it, but I want to know, how did you know that on a behavioral basis? How did you pick out the relevant responses? What if it turns out that every time that you can remember when you ask for somebody to pass you the salt, they happened at that point to have exhaled? Not belched, but just in the process of... Now, is that part of the meaning of pass me the salt, that people respond with exhaling? I want to make it very clear that the difficulty here is not in the specific illustration. I mean, because somebody might go through and work out this illustration. The difficulty is in specifying how you know what is relevant on the behavioral view. What responses are relevant to the meaning of the sentence in question. Another problem is that some sentences simply carry no overt practical response in any non-linguistic behavioral sense. Columbus crossed the sea in 1492. You think I don't know the history of it. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. What behavioral response is relevant to the meaning of that statement? And I say behavioral, not linguistic, because somebody might say, oh, well, the response is when you're asked, when did Columbus come to America? The response is 1492. That's what that gives you a disposition to do. Say 1492 to the question, when did Columbus come to America? But on the behavioral view, there should be something that goes beyond language that gives the meaning to the language. It's not just interlinguistic behavior is referred to. Moreover, the delineation of the appropriate conditions which have to be met before the disposition is realized or is carried out in the case of a behavioral response model, the delineation of them would be, I think, indefinitely complicated if the theory were ever going to become plausible. Because you see, if you're going to give a dispositional analysis, and if you want to go into this, you really should study metaphysics, you know, a bit more. I don't want to get too complicated for you, but dispositional analysis, you know, is hypothetical. Under condition C, if this, then the following happens. But in the case of explaining what my response is to, say, the sentence, your mother just had a heart attack, well, the response that's appropriate in that setting depends upon a lot of things, not the least of which, I believe you in what you're saying. Because you see, if you say that to me and I think you're joking, it's a very sour joke, but I might not do anything. If I believed you, I might run to the telephone to call my father and find out about that. But you see, you have to specify a disposition to call your father to find out, provided you believe the person telling the truth, provided you love your mother, provided that you're not prevented from responding because the police just arrested me and I'm in a squad car and can't get to a telephone, provided I have knowledge of the effective procedures to respond. Maybe I don't know how to use a telephone, and so forth and so on. Again, it's not the details of my chosen illustration I want you to worry about. It's just think about this. To give a dispositional explanation of what the meaning of a sentence is in terms of its appropriate response, you'd have to lay out all the countervailing conditions which are denied as well. But the biggest problem, of course, is that the meaning of sentences does not vary directly. That is, the change of meaning of sentences does not vary directly and proportionately to the distribution of situations and responses in the world. I mean, it really requires a miraculous view of the universe and the way it operates to think that the change of linguistic meaning in a sentence always is corresponding to the direct and proportionate change of distribution of a situation or a response. Let me put it to you in the pedestrian way. There are so many situations and responses that are common to many sentences that it's just impossible to believe that the meaning of a sentence is that situation and the response within it. Because any number of sentences would be appropriate to, for instance, you sitting here and looking at me as I talk. How many of the sentences have that meaning? People sitting there looking at me when I talk. Well, actually, about 9,000 sentences so far. But now people say, yeah, but they didn't write everything. Well, in some cases, they didn't write anything. So there again, the variation of the meaning of the sentences, it doesn't correspond to the distribution of situations and responses in the world. This is just an incredible view of meaning. Yeah, I don't think it can be worked out. Point nine, to back up, I've said that meaning has to do with communicating ideas, but I don't believe meaning is ideational. I said meaning has to do with social conventions, but that doesn't mean that it's a matter of behavioral responses in set situations. I want to make another point. Meaning also involves reference, because we use language to talk about things, where the word about has to be emphasized. Language is used to talk about things, and thus language has something, the meaning of language has something to do with the extra-linguistic world. So yes, meaning has to do with ideas, meaning has to have to do with social conventions, meaning has to do with reference. But in the pattern of my previous points, I'm now going to go on to say that doesn't mean meaning should be identified with that to which an expression refers. Nor should meaning be identified with the referential connection itself. The crude view of this theory is the meaning of an expression is what it refers to. The more sophisticated view is the meaning of the expression is its referring connection. But this is inadequate as well. Why can we not hold to a referential theory of meaning? The meaning is the reference. Well, the most obvious, I think, is because two expressions can have the same referent but very different meanings. Meaning cannot be referent if the same referent is referred to with expressions that have different meanings. The example that I like is of the morning star and the evening star as two expressions. What does the morning star refer to? The planet Venus. What does the evening star expression refer to? The planet Venus. Well, then, since they have the same meaning, we'd have to say that the meaning of morning star, that is, they have the same referent on this view, then the meaning of morning star is identical with the meaning of evening stars. But that's not true, is it? The meaning of morning star is that star which is last visible in the morning. The meaning of evening star is that star first visible in the evening. They don't have the same meaning, and yet they have the same referent. Moreover, two expressions can have the same meaning but different reference. I'm turning my first point around. I first said two expressions can have the same referent but very different meanings. Now I'm going to say two expressions can have the same meaning but very different reference. Think of this expression, the present president of the United States. Does it have one and only one referent? No, it all depends on whether you're speaking in 1914, 1964, 1994. The expression has the same meaning, though, doesn't it? The expression, the present president of the United States, means the same in 1914, 1964, 1994, but it has different reference in each case. Or there are indexical, what are called indexical expressions in our language, like I. I has the same meaning every time it's used, the speaker or the writer. But it doesn't refer to the same person every time, does it? When you say, I'm going to get a Coke, and I say, I'm going to get a Coke, we're not referring to the same I. Other indexical expressions would be this, you, here, now. These things have the same meaning, but they have much different reference depending on the context. A third problem with the referential theory is with what we call syncategrammatic terms. Syncategrammatic terms. I'm going to spell it S-Y-N. C-A-T-E-G-O-R-E-M-A-T-I-C, matic. Syncategrammatic. That is, those terms that refer to things that go along with syn, the categories. The categories refers to Aristotelian philosophy and how Aristotle categorized everything that exists. So a term that refers to something in the categories is a categrammatic term. But there are some terms that don't fit into the categories. Like the word if. If doesn't refer to anything in Aristotle's category of things that exist. It's a syncategrammatic term. The word and. Or here's a very good one. The word is or to be. The word therefore. Now these terms, and, if, is, therefore, have meaning, but they don't have a reference. And the same could be said of what we call modal auxiliary terms. Modal, M-O-D-A-L. Modal auxiliary terms like should, would, might, must. I must get done with this lecture tonight. You should go home and read. What does should or might or must refer to? Another problem with the referential, I'm really beating this one to death, aren't I? Another problem with the referential theory is that a word like dog does not refer to or pick out the class of all dogs as a class. I mean, I can ask you, what is the reference of the word dog? And you can properly say, it is the class of all dogs. That's all well and good. But now when I ask you, what's the meaning of dog, am I trying to pick out the class of dogs? Well, of course not. Why is that? Because when I say, what I want to tell you, the class of dogs is very large. When I want to pick out the class of dogs, I don't say, dog is very large. Which is to say, dog doesn't have the meaning of the class of all dogs, even though it does have that reference. Which this, what I've just proven is that the meaning and the reference are different then. Moreover, the meaning of a phrase cannot be identical with the reference of the phrase, because you can say things of reference that you cannot say of meanings of phrases. Let's try this. The referent of the phrase, the author of Paralandra. What is the referent of the phrase, the author of Paralandra? Don't let me down, you book lovers. C.S. Lewis, thank you. The referent of the phrase, the author of Paralandra, is C.S. Lewis. Now, here's a sentence. The author of Paralandra got married. We had a movie recently about C.S. Lewis getting married. Right? Now, if the referent is identical with the meaning of the expression, then I should be able to substitute the meaning of the expression for the referent. I can say C.S. Lewis got married because he's the author of Paralandra, can I say the meaning of the expression, the author of Paralandra got married? No, meanings don't get married, do they? Reference get married, some do, not all, I mean, stones don't, dogs don't. But some people who are referred to can get married. But obviously, the referent can't be identical with the meaning of an expression because the meaning can't do what the referent does. The meaning can't get married. This is just a long way to pull out this criticism. The referential theory of meaning is not credible. But if it's not credible, and I'm now moving into the philosophical field here, here's my apologetical point, then meaning cannot be limited to what would be experienced or observed if the sentence were true. That is, the referential theory of meaning leads people to say that meaning is limited to what would be experienced if the sentence were true. That is, what referent in my experience is being picked out by the sentence, which is a prejudice of empiricist and pragmatist and positivist in our century. The prejudice that meaning is limited to what would be experienced if the sentence were true. Actually, referential theories of meaning go way back before the positivist in having this particular problem. Sometimes the meaning of a sentence has been identified with the sense data that gives rise to the idea represented by a word. That was John Locke's view, for instance. Or in the case of Peirce and Dewey, the meaning of a sentence is the observable consequences of a word or a sentence. And then, of course, in the case of the positivist, more directly, the meaning of a sentence is the empirical conditions for verifying the truth of the sentence. In all of these cases, which are referential theories of meaning, meaningfulness is necessarily connected with sensory experience. And in doing this, the prejudice of the philosophers comes out because they've confused a criterion of meaningfulness with a theory of meaning. Please notice there's a difference. They've confused a criterion of meaningfulness with a theory of meaning. To claim that only sentences which are empirically testable are meaningful is nothing more but a ritual prejudice. It's one that I've had to live with all through my academic career, and that's why I speak with some disdain of it. It looks also scholarly and philosophical as a way of telling people you can't talk about God, you can't talk about ethics, and so forth, but it's nothing more but a ritual prejudice, lacking any accurate and cogent criterion of linguistic meaningfulness. This has in fact been shown to be an embarrassingly narrow and self-contradictory theory. Self-contradictory because on this criterion of meaningfulness, the criterion itself is meaningless, right? In every version of it, it's always come back to that. Okay, so I have admitted that language communicates ideas, but I haven't bought the ideational theory of meaning. I have admitted that language is controlled by social convention, but I have not bought the behavioral stimulus response theory of meaning. And I've also said that meaning involves reference, because we use language to talk about things, but I certainly don't hold to any of the referential theories of meaning, much less the prejudice that accompanies it in saying that the criterion of meaningfulness is some kind of connection with sensory experience. Well, and Dr. Bronson, what do you want to say? Rather than just these bits and pieces. Thesis 10. A particular sentence in a natural language is a tool of its user by which he intends to accomplish something. A particular sentence in a natural language is a tool of its user, underline the word tool, by which he intends to accomplish something. Earlier we said he intends to do something. Speech is a kind of action, looking for a response according to convention. Now I'm specifying more, that it's a tool, if you will, this is a metaphor, a tool of its user by which he intends to accomplish something, It's an action according to a convention expecting a certain kind of response. Now, what kinds of things might he try to accomplish? Well, according to a fairly standard breakdown, which I still think is helpful, language is used to inform, to express, to evoke, to command, and to perform. Let me say it again. Sometimes language is used for informing, as when I tell you, class will begin at 7 o'clock tomorrow evening sharp. Language can be used to express things. I say, I hate it when students are late. Now, that might also be a description of me, but more likely when it's said in that way, it's really expressing a feeling. Language can be used to evoke a response in the hearer. Maybe I want you to feel a certain way, and so I use language to try to bring out your feelings of disdain for students that are late to class. Here I'm not expressing my own feeling, I'm trying to get you to feel something. Language can be used to command, right? And you say, don't you dare be late to class tomorrow. Now I'm uttering a requirement for you. By the way, I could utter that requirement to evoke a response, right? I could be commanding as well as trying to evoke your compliance. Okay, so I'm not saying these have to function separately, but the language also is used for performing certain deeds. Well-known illustration, when in a wedding someone says, I do, they are not describing anything, informing us, nor are they expressing anything, or evoking, or commanding. What are they doing? They're performing a vow, or making a promise. And language is being used to accomplish that. In fact, without language, you couldn't do it. Or something that's a surrogate of language, like nodding your head in the place of saying, I do. But the point is, the I do is not information or expression or command. It's performance. It's the performing of a vow. Okay, so a particular sentence in a natural language is a tool of its user by which he intends to inform, express, evoke, command, or perform. Now, as such, the thing I like about this metaphor, notice, as such, the tool can be used skillfully or clumsily. The tool, which is the sentence that I've been talking about here, this sentence can be used skillfully. It can also be used clumsily. And because people can be clumsy in the use of their linguistic tool, the use of their sentence, it may turn out they don't express themselves very well at all. What if I say, tomorrow night we'll all meet at the cemetery? And then around 7 o'clock you all go out to the cemetery, and I'm not there, but I'm waiting at the seminary and wondering, where are all my students? I told them to come here tonight. But you see, I was very clumsy in the use of my sentence. I meant seminary, I said cemetery. Now that's a real easy illustration. But there are other sorts of clumsy uses of language that don't accomplish what we want. But, you see, it's like a tool. I may have an excellent hammer out in my garage. The fact that it's an excellent hammer doesn't mean that I'm not going to just wallop the dickens out of the board that I'm trying to nail. All right? And so, again, when I call language a tool to accomplish an end, I don't mean necessarily people use the tool well. But that is what they're doing, is they're trying to use a tool to accomplish informing, expressing, evoking, commanding, performing. And the linguistic tool, the sentence, must be forged in accordance with the contemporary and common usage and the social structures of the community in which I use the tool. We've touched on this enough that I'm just going to mention it here. But now I'm adding, it's the contemporary and common usages. And if I were to walk up to a woman and call her a tart, and she gets offended, and then I were to refer to some ancient use of the word tart where that is in fact a compliment, I would not have actually been conforming to the conventions of my society. That would be a kind of a cop-out. In fact, that would call for a very complicated explanation. But really, what was I doing when I called her a tart? it might have appeared, I mean, I'm saying I was trying to compliment her. But since I know that's not the way the word tart is used today and how it'd be taken, you'd really have to say, I was trying, I mean, I'd be doing something that's sarcastic, trying to provoke trouble, but have an escape hatch available to me, you know, where I say, oh, no, you didn't understand me, and so forth. Don't you hate it when people do that?
It's a critique of school Mormonism.
Yeah. That happens, though. People, you know, will do that. The use of the tool must be forged. The linguistic tool must be forged in accordance with contemporary and common usage in the social structures of that community. Okay. Now we're going to make hay. Out of all these observations, and you put this in the light of what I've been teaching you, although text, okay, you find a book here, there's a text here, or a Bible, a text there. Although texts are never in themselves impersonal, that is, they're never divorced from a personal speaker or writer who speaks with a purpose and an intention. Texts are never in themselves impersonal. They can become or can be considered isolated, as isolated from their authors, and isolated from information about their authors. Okay, I have a book in my hand. It happens to be the Bible, but it could be any book. I have a book, and here's a text in the book, or the book as a whole. Now, this, as a linguistic token, is not impersonal. There was an author who wrote this with an intention. However, this text can get isolated from the author, can't it? I'm not able to interview Isaiah. Or, conceivably, I pick this up and I don't even know that it's from the book of Isaiah in the Bible. I don't even know that. I'm just reading this text. Or maybe I know nothing about Isaiah. The text can be isolated from the person and from information about the person. In which case, they still, the text, or in this case, the particular text, in which case they still bear a range of possible abstract meanings. They still bear a range of possible abstract meanings given the semantic, syntactic, and cultural context of the time. What's the best way to interpret Isaiah's words? Have Isaiah right there and ask him some questions. Okay, but now, you know I'm being silly. Those of us who are doing biblical hermeneutics don't get a chance to, you know, do that. I guess some schools of theology feel you can do that, but we don't believe that. You can't talk to Isaiah today, or to Paul, and so forth, and interrogate them with what they meant, what were they intending, and so forth and so on. Does that mean, given what I've taught you tonight, the text has no meaning? No, because the text, as a verbal token, linguistic token, still bears a range of possible abstract meanings given the semantic, syntactic, and cultural context of the time. What may have appeared to get me out on a limb here, so that if we don't have the author around to explain his linguistic speech acts, we can't know his meaning, actually, in the light of what I've explained to you, saves us, because he could only have meant something what? Given the social conventions of his time. And that means that even though I don't know Isaiah, and I may not have any information, that if I know the culture, if I know the semantics and syntactics of that language, I can tell you what the range, it may be big, it may be small, but we have some idea of what this could possibly mean. And so the original meaning of a text, or a sentence, if you will, the inherent, determinate meaning, we do not have to surrender or say is engulfed by the response of the hearer or reader. It is not engulfed in the subjective effect of the text. This is a very popular way of looking at things today. People will say, well, we don't have the author here, and therefore this text only means what it means to me. All right? This means what response it evokes from me. That isn't true. It is simply, I mean, it's one of the biggest fallacies that I see when I read modern hermeneutics. It's like, well, we're cut off from the author, so I guess we just have to go to reader response. No, you don't. Not if you understand the way language works. Original meaning is not engulfed by the response of the reader or the subjective effects. Why? Because, as I've said, interpreters must work in terms of a linguistic social structure, and that means in terms of certain continuities. Secondly, the interpreter must choose to agree or disagree with what he is interpreting. The idea that reader response is the meaning of a text would make it impossible for you ever to disagree with the text. Because how could you disagree with your response? Your response is your response. You can't say, okay, here's the meaning of the text, my response. Oh, I disagree with that. No, your response is your response to the text. So you're responding to the meaning of the text. Since you have to choose to agree or disagree with what you're interpreting, there is a distinction between your response and the author's meaning. It's inescapable. It's one of the wonders of modern scholarship that this insight, which is so obvious, just eludes so many people. It's as though, well, the meaning has to be what my response is to it. No, because your response, think about what you said, your response is in the nature of the case, not the meaning of what you're responding to. Shall I say that again? Your response is not constituted, it does not constitute the meaning of what you're responding to, or else it's not a response, is it? And thirdly, the hearer or reader is responding to what is taken as the inherent intended meaning of the text or utterance, that is, its perceived character. That's just the point I was saying to you, put more academically. He's responding, quote-unquote, to what he takes as the inherent or intended meaning of the text or utterance, its perceived character. Okay, so our circuitous route has brought us to the point of asking three key questions. This, I think, is number 11. Or is it 12? 11. Sorry, I didn't number it in my notes.
12.
Number 12. Okay, here are the three key questions. One, is there an inherent meaning or a single determinate meaning to an utterance or a text? Now, I'm going to repeat that because this has been formulated exactly, or I tried to. Is there, underline is, does it exist, is it real? Is there an inherent meaning or a single determinate meaning to an utterance or a text? So I'm talking about verbal acts, like I'm making utterances right now, but also text, which are tokens, linguistic tokens. And the question is there an inherent meaning or single determinate meaning to an utterance or text? And my answer is, usually. Usually. Stroke of genius. Everybody says yes or no. Why can't the answer be somewhere in between? I think the answer is usually there is an inherent determinate meaning. Unless the author was lazy, sloppy, or purposely poetic. That is, there are texts which are purposely ambiguous. They're left vague because that's part of the point, is to be vague. And that's okay. I mean, we're not trying to have a rule of hermeneutics that says you can't be vague. But there is no inherent meaning if the whole purpose was to write something to evoke a lot of different kinds of responses. But usually that's not the case. Usually the author is not being lazy or being sloppy. I mean, when a person writes something when he's drunk, maybe you can't find the meaning of it. Okay? But that's hardly normative for what we mean by the meaning of a sentence. So again, the first question, is there an inherent meaning or a single determinate meaning to an utterance or text? My answer is, usually. Usually there is, unless the author was lazy or sloppy or purposely poetic and ambiguous. The second question is this meaning discoverable? Is this meaning discoverable? And it's characteristic of modern writing and hermeneutics to confuse those two questions. The one question is, metaphysical. The other question is epistemological. Metaphysical in senses, I'm asking, does something exist? Is there a meaning? Now the question is, can it be discovered? And my answer is, first, not necessarily. In terms of our general hermeneutics, I don't think we can say that the meaning of every text is necessarily discoverable. You can think of extreme examples, right? What if we were to find something that appears for all intents and purposes to be writing? But it comes from a culture we know nothing about. Maybe this is the only piece of writing we have from that culture. Now, the fact that I believe that there is a determinate meaning to this text doesn't mean that I can discover what it is. And somebody says, well, you can't discover it, so it doesn't exist. That's a philosophical prejudice of massive proportions. So not necessarily. By the way, that was an extreme example. There may be texts which we know a lot about, and still we just don't have enough information or context that we can figure out or be real clear what the author was doing with it. The second way I'm going to, well, not second way, but I'm going to go, my answer is not necessarily and not always easily. Not always easily. The question is this determinate meaning discoverable? I'm saying not necessarily and not always easily. What complicates interpretation? Three things. Well, this is just one way to cut the cake. You can be a lot more detailed if you want, but I'll cover it quickly. Three things complicate interpretation. First, a lack of knowledge of the culture, semantics, and syntactics of the text. A lack of knowledge. I already gave you an example of that. We have some writing on a piece of vellum here, but we don't know anything about the culture from which it came. We don't know the meaning of the terms or the grammar, and so that complicates finding the meaning. Well, that's a case of not being able to get it at all. But it may be that we don't have enough information about, let's say, terms in the Bible or a particular linguistic expression or enough about the cultural background to figure out why Paul speaks of baptism for the dead. What is that all about? Well, maybe you just didn't have to say it. At this point, we can't say because we don't have enough information. Secondly, interpretation is complicated by mistakes that are made regarding syntactics and semantics by the interpreter or the author himself. If we're reading a line in Shakespeare, we may have trouble interpreting it if the author himself made a mistake in his semantics or syntactics. We should have known this. We know that we have to read the papers of our children that come home from school. And sometimes we know that they didn't mean what they actually put down in the paper, right? Well, even grown authors can make mistakes, you know. And so if you're reading an author, now in the case of the Bible, mind you, we don't have that problem. But if we're, you know, in general trying to interpret a text and the author's made a mistake, or if we're reading even an infallible text like the Bible, and I'm wrong about the meaning of a word, I'm wrong about Greek grammar or Hebrew syntax, then of course that's going to complicate things, right? So if we have a lack of knowledge, or if we make mistakes, that's going to get in the way. And then thirdly, and this is the killer, sometimes interpretation is complicated by misconstruing the author's sense or intent, misconstruing his ideas or his purpose. I want you to put both those down. We can misconstrue the ideas of the author or the purpose of the author in communicating them because we have not carefully distinguished them from the interpreter's own initial personal response to the text or our own social and linguistic conventions. If we don't take the time to distance ourselves and our initial response from the author, we may misconstrue what he is talking about. An example that Berkeley Michelson uses in his text that I like very much is that English readers, when they first come to the book of Romans and read that Paul is a servant of Jesus Christ, Well, you know, the word servant in 20th century culture has a completely different connotation than it did in Paul's culture. Who has servants in our culture? Hey, very elite, wealthy people, right? And so we might think of servant of Jesus Christ as the emphasis placed on Jesus is distant from us and wealthy. Whereas in Paul's day and age, the emphasis of servant was more on the humble submission to a master. So if we take our initial response and confuse it with what Paul is saying, we're going to misconstrue what he's trying to communicate to us. And then a second kind of misconstruing of the author's ideas or purposes comes from the prejudices of the interpreter or his own agenda and aims. And the fact is, we could take a whole evening preaching about this, gentlemen. I mean, I'm going to cover it in one sentence, but this is the biggest problem with hermeneutics. Even when we don't make the mistake of confusing our initial response with what the author was intending, confusing our own social and linguistic conventions with the conventions of the ancient world or what have you, the fact is the prejudices of the interpreter and his own agenda get in the way of him hearing what the author is saying. And I, for one, am insulted and indignant that you have schools of linguistic interpretation who honor that by saying that's what you're supposed to do. You're actually supposed to take an author and make use of him in the way that fits your own agenda. And thus we have Marxist hermeneutics, feminist hermeneutics in our day, homosexual hermeneutics in our day. A whole point being to take texts and always turn them to the social agenda or personal interests and prejudices of the interpreter. It is a crime. It is a crime for an interpreter to read into the text what he wants to find there. It is a crime for an interpreter to become creative with what another man or woman has written and turn it to his own ends. And the Bible tells us that all sinners are criminals in this very way. That all sinners hear the Word of God and twist it. Purposely twist it, because they do not want to encounter this kind of God. They do that, of course, in the non-linguistic revelation of God and the creation round about them. How much more should we expect them to twist the verbal revelation of God, which is going to be all the more pointed to their hearts, and they try to deflect that and not get the point. So, is the meaning discoverable? My answer, not necessarily, not always easily. Because interpretation is complicated by a lack of knowledge of culture, semantics, and syntactics, mistakes that are made regarding syntactics and semantics by the interpreter or the author, and the misconstruing of the author's sense or intent, because we don't distinguish his social linguistic conventions from our own personal response and setting, or because of the prejudices of the interpreter and his own agenda and aims. The third major question, may the understanding or interpretation of an utterance or text be arbitrary or inconsistent? And I guess you know what your professor's going to say here. No, interpretation may not be arbitrary. It may not be inconsistent. If we allow arbitrariness in interpretation, then we are not reading out, we are not exegeting the meaning of a text, we're reading into it. And therefore, one of the key things you must learn from this course is that when you offer an interpretation of a text, you must be able to show a reason for that interpretation. And by a reason, I don't mean an aim or a purpose that you're accomplishing. I mean by that you must give evidence of various kinds that this is not just your arbitrary opinion. May the understanding or interpretation be inconsistent? Again, the answer is no. Your methodology must be consistent with the way that you proceed elsewhere. in interpreting text. That is to say, hermeneutics must be rule governed and restrained by guidelines. If it is not rule governed and restrained by guidelines, the utterances and text that we interpret it may mean anything, and whenever they can mean anything at all, they mean nothing at all. And one of the criticisms you'll see in one of your assigned readings that I make of a contemporary, a reformed writer, who is a personal friend of mine and a very brilliant man, but one of the criticisms I make of his hermeneutical procedure is that by means of these procedures, you could prove anything. And if you can prove anything, that's as good as being arbitrary, so you have not really proven anything at all. Nothing has been proven when it's open to everything. We've come to the end of our time. I didn't finish the lecture that I've prepared for you, but I'm close enough to be happy. Tomorrow evening we're going to take up now and ask ourselves, what are we talking about when we talk about the meaning of a sentence or an utterance? The meaning of a sentence or utterance. And I'm going to first explain to you why sentences are being referred to, not words by themselves. And then I'm going to go through the various ways in which the meaning of a sentence can be spoken of. And I have seven of them, just so you can think about this. We talk about the sense of the sentence, the referent of the sentence, the purpose or aim of the sentence, the effect or result of the sentence. We may mean substitute sentences, we may mean explanation of the sentence, or the operational guidelines for using the sentence. All of them are used from time to time when people talk about the meaning of a sentence. And it's just a good idea for those of us who are doing hermeneutics to figure out what people are talking about when they want to talk about meaning. Okay, any questions or comments before we end tonight? Yes, Mike?
Go. I don't know if you could find it on your notes, but I'm looking for the... Oh, I didn't follow the one argument. I was getting the other one down. It was under the... your refutation of the meaning as is just simply reference.
Yeah,
and it was the fourth point, and you said words like dog does not mean the class of all dogs, but the reference. But it does refer to the class of all dogs.
Yeah. If you let's say, okay, I have the word dog, and I ask you, what is the referent of that word? And if you answer the class of all dogs, no problem. Mm-hmm. If I say, what is the meaning of that word, and if you say, it is the class of all dogs, then there's a real problem. Because if the meaning is the class of all dogs, in the example I gave you, then to use the word dog, what I mean to do is pick out the class of dogs. If meaning is referent, then the meaning is picking out the class of dogs. But of course, I don't always use the word dog to pick out the class, or vice versa. Because if I want to say it's a very big class, I don't say dog is very big. Mm-hmm. But I should be able to if it picks out the class of dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just another way of showing that meaning and reference are a different thing. Because I do agree that the referent of the word is the class of dogs.
Right. Or the other way around, is dogs are fluffy, wouldn't mean the class of dogs is fluffy.
Yeah, right.
The reform writer that you were speaking of, you don't agree with the hermeneutic?
Yes, that is so open-ended that you could prove anything by means of it.
His initials aren't GM, are they?
No, actually not. It's Vernon Poythress that I was referring to.
Oh,
and I have great respect for him. I want to make that clear. He's a very intelligent man. But sometimes intelligence can be your downfall, too, because you get so creative that you can do just about anything with the text that you want. And somebody's got to be the little boy sitting on the side saying, hey, I'm not as cute or creative, you know, in my use of language, but I don't think the king has any clothes on either. Because if you can be that creative to draw in all these different things to make something mean what you want, then you haven't really done hermeneutics, I don't think. And by the way, I should also say that I'm sure Dr. Poythress would want to say that's true, if you can prove anything. And it's just that his approach, he doesn't think is guilty of that, but I think it is. And that's why I have you reading that at some point in your assignments in our class. Okay, well, thanks so much. We'll rejoin tomorrow night and pick up the meaning of sentences.